8. "Who are you?" said Turl. He had no trouble at all in seeing the figure who stood in the shadow of the post. It was a brilliantly clear moonlit night, so bright that even the snow-capped peaks of the Rockies gleamed. Lars Thorensen had brought the newcomer down to the cage at Senior Councilman Staffer's request. Lars had totally flunked out of pilot training after trying a combat maneuver so impossible that it crashed him, wiped out a plane, and cracked his neck. He had been appointed language assistant to the council. The plaster cast collar he was wearing did not interfere with his talking. He had been told to bring the newcomer down to the cage, turn off the electricity, hand in a mine radio, give the newcomer another mine radio, and then, with no mine radio of his own, withdraw. Lars was very punctilious about his duties. He had accepted the appointment on the condition that he could now also spread fascism among the tribes, which made both him and his father very happy. This newcomer had really stunk up the ground car. Suddenly, Lars remembered he was also to tell the cadet on guard duty to go elsewhere, so he rushed off to find him and tell him just that. Turl looked at this newcomer, hoping his contempt for the animal wouldn't show through his face mask or sound in his voice. He knew all about General Smith of the Brigantes. As security officer, war officer, and political officer of this planet, he was very well informed about this band. Like all security officers before him, Turl had accepted the situation of a human group in a rainy forest who couldn't be reached or observed, and who had developed a symbiotic relationship with the Cyclos. The Brigantes had kept all other races wiped out and had delivered hundreds of thousands of Bantu and Pygmies to the branch mine site. The only attraction that place had was that you could occasionally buy a human creature to torture. Yes, Turl not only knew all about them, but he had personally engineered their transport over here. Turl had persuaded the creature's staffer that what he needed was a true and reliable corps of troops for this place. Staffer had vehemently agreed. You couldn't trust those Scots. They were too sly and treacherous. You also shouldn't use cadets who seemed to have some damnable and misplaced admiration for that Tyler. The Brigantes had come, but Staffer seemed to be having trouble with the negotiation with them, so Turl had suggested their chief be sent down.
"Who are you?"
repeated Turl in the mine radio. Did the creature speak Cyclo, as was reported? Yes, the next words were Cyclo, but a Cyclo spoken as though the thing had goo food in its mouth.
"The question be, who the crap crud be you?"
said General Smith.
"I am Turl, the chief security officer of this planet."
"Then what be you doing in a cage?"
"An observation post that keeps the humans out."
"Ah,"
said Smith, understanding. Who did this Cyclo think he was fooling?
"I understand," said Turl, "that you have had some difficulty coming to terms." "You crud brain, I pull you out of a jungle and you don't realize my power."
"It be the back pay,"
said Smith. It seemed quite natural to be talking to a Cyclo over a mine radio. He had never talked to one any other way. So maybe this interview was on the level after all. This Cyclo knew the proper form.
"Back pay?" said Turl.
He could understand somebody being concerned about that, but he thought it was a barter system of explosive ingredients for humans.
"We was hired by the International Bank," said Smith.
He knew his legends, and he knew his rights, and he was very good at trading. Very good indeed.
"At $100 a day per man, we ain't been paid."
"How many men? How long?"
said Turl.
"I calculate in rough figures 1,000 men for, let's say, 1,000 years."
The rapid skill Turl had with mathematics told him this was $36,500 a year per man, $36,500,000 per year for all the men, and $36,500,000,000 in total. But he made a test.
"Why,"
said Turl in a shocked voice.
That's more than 1,000,000.
Smith nodded gravely.
Just so. They won't agree to it.
This Cyclo knew when he was in a boxed ambush. Maybe he could do business with him after all. Turl had his answer. The piece of crap couldn't do common arithmetic.
You were hired, you say, by the International Bank to take Kisangani of Ozaïre and then take Kinshasa and overthrow the government and wait for bank representatives to come in and negotiate for proper payment of loans. Is that right?
Smith had said nothing of the sort, not in that detail. The legends were a trifle vague. But he realized abruptly that he was talking to somebody who really knew his business. Turl always knew his business. He hadn't even bothered to review any of this. It was a security chief joke, and had been for more than 1,000 years on this planet. They had had all the details from a captured mercenary, properly interrogated over several days way back when. It had made delicious reading.
But your ancestors,
Turl bore on remorselessly,
only captured Kisangani. They never went on to capture Kinshasa.
Smith had dimly known that, but he had hoped it wouldn't come up. His ancient forebears had been crudely interrupted by the Cyclo invasion. He wasn't sure what was coming now.
You see, said Turl, the International Bank has been taken over.
He hoped this crap brain would swallow this outrageous set of lies.
The Galactic Bank, located in the Gradides system, bought them out.
Gradides system? Gulped Smith.
You know, said Turl. Universe 8.
This much was true, where the Galactic Bank was. Always sweeten lies with a little truth.
Ah, said Smith, totally adrift.
He better watch it. This Cyclo would swindle him. It had happened before. He was on the alert.
And, lied Turl, you will be glad to know that it took over all obligations of the International Bank, and that includes yours.
This quick reversal almost spun Smith.
So as one of the agents for the Galactic Bank,
if he only were,
I am authorized to pay you the back pay. But your ancestors only did half their job, so you only get half the back pay. That would be $500,000.
He was wondering what a dollar was.
I'm sure that will be acceptable.
Smith came out of his fog like a shot. He had expected nothing.
Yes, he said deliberately. I think I can persuade my men to accept that.
Creepo. That would be $10 a man and the rest for himself.
Riches. Now, is there any other trouble? Quarters? They found you quarters?
Smith said yes. They'd given them a whole surbub in the town up there, a square mile of old houses and buildings in the outskirts. Bad repair, but palaces, really.
You should also insist on some uniforms, said Turl.
He was looking at this filthy creature over there in its monkey skins and crossed bandoliers of poisoned arrows and a diamond in a peaked leather cap.
You should also clean yourself up, comb your fur, look more military.
This was rank criticism. Smith became very cross. He himself was spit and polish, and so was his unit. All 20 of his commandos, 50 men in each, properly officered, trained to the nth degree. He slowed down, hoping they wouldn't notice it was only 35 to the commando these days, the food situation being what it had become.
And food? Said Turl.
Smith was startled. Could this Cyclo read his mind?
Food is bad, said Smith. There be plenty of dead bodies in those houses, but they be old and dried and unfit to eat. There would got to be a clause in any future contract about better food.
Belatedly, Turl remembered that these Brigantes were reputed cannibals, a fact that had lessened their trade with the mindsite over the centuries. Sternly, he said,
There can be no such clause.
His whole plan could be wrecked if they threw these creatures out. His studies, when he was doing the load plan, had isolated some data in Chinko books indicating that these human animals curiously objected to cannibalism. He had at one time considered using the Brigantes for his gold plan, but they had been far away, and also they might have run around yammering about no food due to the scarcity of humans in these parts.
"For the duration of this contract," said Turl, "you will just have to put up with cattle as food."
"It tastes funny," said the Brigante chief.
He was willing to concede the point. His brigade had had to eat an awful lot of water buffalo and monkey and elephant, but it wouldn't do to be too agreeable. Be a hard bargainer.
"But all right, if the pay is good."
Turl told him, then, that he himself intended to go back to Cyclo very soon, and he would personally collect their back pay at the Galactic Bank and return it here. And that, meanwhile, they should hire on as the sentries and military force of this compound and the Council.
"You'll bring the back pay back," said Snith. "All 500,000.
"Yes, you have my word on it."
"The word of a Cyclo?" Snith said.
"I and 6 of my picked men will go with you to see that you do."
Although Turl didn't know whether the Imperial government would want to interrogate them, the Imperial government would want a very important, knowledgeable man, he readily agreed. Who cared about what happened to Smith once Turl's plan was executed?
"Of course, and welcome," smiled Turl. "Providing, of course, you help me all you can until we go. Anything else?"
Yes, there was. Smith fished out something and gingerly approached the cage. He laid it down between the temporarily de-electrified bars and withdrew as was proper. Turl tugged his chain over and picked the item up.
"They want to pay us in that stuff," said Smith. "It's only printed on one side, and I think it might be counterfeit."
Turl took it closer to a cage light. What was this thing? He couldn't read any of the characters on it.
"I doubt you can even read this," he challenged.
"Oh, yes, I did," said Smith.
He couldn't read either, but somebody had read it to him.
"It do say it is one credit and is legal for the payment of all debts. And around the picture it says, Johnny Goodboy Tyler, the conqueror of the Cyclos."
That was what disturbed him, really, that the Cyclos were said to have been conquered. Turl thought fast.
"Indeed, it is a counterfeit, and a lie as well."
"I thought so," said Smith.
"They always tried to trick you. His ancestors had known that very firmly. Trick before you are tricked, they used to say about all dealings."
"But I'll tell you what I will do,"
said Turl into the mine radio.
"Just so you know who you are really working for, you accept this and say nothing, and when we get to the Galactic Bank, I will redeem it in cold, hard cash."
That was fair. Now he knew who he was really working for. Made a lot of sense. Quite proper. Paid by one group, but working for another. This Cyclo was straight after all.
"That's fine," said Smith. "By the way, I know that man in the picture."
Turl looked closer. The light had been bad. By crap, it did look like his animal. He tried to remember whether he had ever heard its name. Yes, he dimly recalled the strange words. Yes, it was the damned animal.
"That bird just waltzed in and wiped out a whole commando of mine," said Smith. "Not too long ago. Attacked them without even a salute, mowed them down, and then stole their bodies and a truckload of trade goods."
"Where?"
"In the forest. Where else?"
This was news.
His intelligence said that this creature in the picture had been flying around visiting tribes. Or maybe this was how he visited tribes. That was probably it. Turl knew he himself would visit tribes that way. Ah, well, he knew Staffer would be very, very happy indeed to know that. The animal was not where he was thought to be, and he was making war on peaceful tribes. Staffer was a very apt political pupil. Now he would make him a very apt military pupil, in the dumb way that was the only one possible. But to business. He put the banknote back on the ledge between the bars, withdrew, and Smith retrieved it.
So, we've settled the contract matter, and you can negotiate it further, said Turl. Get settled in, and in a very few weeks, or even sooner, you'll be doing your duty here. Right?
Indeed so, said Smith.
And as a bonus, said Turl, I'll persuade certain parties to authorize you to kill the animal who wronged you on sight.
That was very, very good. And Smith was driven back to the old city by a dutiful Lars, who endured the stink in the name of spreading the righteous creed of fascism and the great military leader Hitler. 9. The underground room at the Lake Victoria mine site was chilled. Angus had rigged heavy-duty motor cooling coils along the wall, and the humidity in the air dripped from them and made dark pools along the floor. The metal and mineral analysis machine hummed. Its screen cast an eerie green light on everything around it. 5 tense faces were turned to that screen. Dr. McKendrick's, Angus's, Sir Robert's, Dunnell Dean's, and Johnny's. Massive, more than 18 inches in diameter, the ugly head of the Cyclo corpse lay on the machine's plate. Such a head was mostly bone. It bore considerable resemblance to a human head and could be mistaken for one in bad light. But where a human had hair, eyebrows, fleshy lips, nose, and ears, the Cyclo had bone whose shape was more or less the same as the corresponding human features, and the distribution and spacing were similar. The result was a kind of caricature of a human head. Until you touched the features, they did not seem to be bone, but contact proved them hard and unyielding. The analysis machine was not penetrating the head. Not only were the features bone, but the whole top half of the skull was bone. As the parson in his earlier, inexpert autopsy had discovered, the brain was low down and to the back. He had discovered nothing in the brain because he had not opened the brain of the cadavers.
Bone, said Angus. That's almost as hard to penetrate as metal.
Johnny could attest to that from the negligible effects of his kill club on Turl's skull back in the morgue. Angus was resetting dials. The Cyclo letters were codings for various metals and ores. He swung the intensity dial up 5 clicks.
Wait, said McKendrick. Back it up one. I thought I saw something.
Angus backed the intensity of penetration dial back 1, then 2. It was sitting on lime now. There was a hazy difference in density on the screen. One little spot. Angus adjusted the beam's in-depth control, focusing it. The internal bones and fissures of the skull came clear on the screen. 5 pairs of eyes watched intensely. The Scot's fingers took another knob, one that swept a second beam to various positions in the subject.
Wait, said McKendrick. Move the beam back to about 2 inches behind the mouth cavity. There. Now focus it again. Then, that's it.
There was something there, something hard and black on the screen that was not passing waves at this intensity. Angus touched the recorder of the machine, and the whir-flap sound of registry of the images on the paper roll was loud.
They do have something in their skulls, said Robert the Fox. Not so fast, said McKendrick. We jump to new conclusions. It could be some fragment of an old injury, some metal picked up in a mine explosion.
No, said Robert the Fox. That's very plain.
Johnny had pulled out the recording sheets. They had the metal analysis trace squiggling down one side. He had left the Cyclo metal analysis code book, usually used to analyze drone transmissions as they hunted a surface for ore, outside. It was chill and dank and odorous in this room, and he didn't care much for this job, vital as it was. He took this opportunity to go out and look it up. Page after page, he compared the squiggle he had with the illustrations. It took a long time. He was no expert at this. He couldn't find it. Then he got clever and began to compare composites of two squiggle illustrations. The cycloengineers who would do this sort of thing could probably have told him with no code book. He cursed the anger of the Russians who, believing they were avenging their colonel, had slaughtered the cyclos. The four in the guarded room of the dormitory were in very bad condition. Two of them were ordinary miners. One was an executive by his clothes and papers, and the other was an engineer. McKendrick was very doubtful that they would make it. He had extracted bullets and sewn them up, but they were all still unconscious, or appeared so, and they lay there in the breathe-gas ventilated room, chained to their beds, breathing shallowly. There wasn't even a first-aid handbook for cyclos that Johnny had ever seen. He didn't think there was one issued. The company might require all bodies to be returned, but it didn't require that anybody keep them alive, a fact that tended to confirm that the sole reason for returning dead cyclo bodies was to prevent examination by alien eyes. There was no sentiment involved. There were never even any hospital sections in these compounds, and mine accidents were very frequent. Hold it. One of these squiggles in the book almost matched. Copper. Now if he could find the little tail squiggle somewhere. Here it was. Tin. He overlaid the two squiggles. They seemed to match better. Copper and tin? Not quite. There was a tiny squiggle remaining. He searched for it. He found it. Lead. Mainly copper, some tin, and a little bit of lead. He put the patterns one on top of the other. They matched now. There was another code book, very thick, called Composite Ore Bodies for Drone Scan Analysis, and because it had about 10,000 characters in it, he had shunned it. But this one he had just done made a lookup easy. He looked under Copper Deposits, then its subheading, Tin Deposits, and then its subheading, Lead Deposits, and he found his squiggle. Not only that, he found, by comparing it to variations, that the analysis of per-11s, cyclos used the 11 integer, was 5 copper, 4 tin, and 2 lead. He went further and looked this up in a man book, and it said bronze for such a combination. Apparently, it was a very durable alloy that lasted for centuries, and there had even been a Bronze Age where implements were mainly bronze. Great. But it struck him as funny that an advanced technical race should be using ancient bronze in a skull. Amusing. He went back inside with his findings to discover that McKendrick, with a hammer and chisel-like instrument, had been taking the head apart. Johnny was just as glad not to have been around to watch that.
"We searched all through the rest of the skull with the machine," said Angus. "That's the only odd thing in there."
"I went through its pockets," said Robert the Fox. "He is the lowest class miner. His identity card says his name was Kla, and he had 41 years' service and 3 wives back on Cyclo."
"The company paid them benefits?" said Donaldine.
"No," said Robert the Fox.